You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
On July 25th, 1990, a man named Curtis Durden was with 3 friends in front of his apartment building in Oakland, California, when armed men approached, demanding money. Despite the victim's compliance, the assailants pistol-whipped one man and fatally shot Curtis Durden before fleeing the scene. The police quickly found 17-year-old Jerome Dixon about a block and a half away in the street, flagging down a ride. When brought to the scene to be identified by the victims, none of them recognized Jerome. Nevertheless, after a lengthy interrogation, he admitted to being one of the assailants. What would be stronger evidence in the mind of a jury? Eyewitness testimony or a confession? Jerome's attorney advised him to be smart and take a plea deal. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where today we have a juvenile false confession case. And, you know, it hurts my heart, the number of these that we've seen before. So many names come to mind. Thomas Cogdell, Sean Tyler, Marcus Wiggins, the West Memphis Three. The list is too long and too tragic to complete. And you can hear these type of stories, so many more of them, every one of them different, every one of them insane, but all involving false confessions on our show, aptly titled Wrongful Conviction, False Confessions. It's going to be linked in our bio. And this story is no less terrifying than any of those. But our guest today, Jerome Dixon, well, he's come out the other side, survived an unbelievable ordeal, and he's come out thriving. And Jerome, we're happy and honored to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And with him, civil rights attorney at McLean, Bednarski & Litt, Ben Shaw. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Now, this happened in Oakland, California, right?
That is correct. Oakland, California.
Can you tell us a bit about growing up there?
Sure. I come from a big family. There's 8 in all, 6 sisters, 1 brother, and I'm the baby with the twin sister. I came up in the air when MC Hammer was topping the charts. I dressed like MC Hammer. My hairstyle was like MC Hammer. I remember having a honey blonde Gumby cut with a streak that just went from the tip of my forehead to the back. And I just knew that I was the man. I was little Mr. MC Hammer.
So forgive me in advance, but is it safe to say that you were too legit to quit?
100%. Too legit to quit.
But all jokes aside, though, the MC Hammer era also coincided with the era of the crack epidemic, and this was the late 80s into the early 90s.
Correct. In retrospect, I saw the devastation of a lot of communities, people of color. Crack was just taking its toll on a lot of families in so many dire ways.
And Oakland was no stranger to that devastation and the heavy-handed policing that came with the crack era.
It was not a good atmosphere for people of color. You were always targeted. And it was just a bad environment in all. Law enforcement were, they were not friends.
Right. And so that's the backdrop, right? This was the summer of 1990, July 25th, to be exact. And the victim in this case, Curtis Durden, was hanging out in front of his apartment building with his friend Jeff Simmons and two young women. And armed men approached them. Now, Ben, what can you tell us about the crime itself?
It was basically a robbery, as best we can tell, where a few young men sort of come up. They demand that everybody get down on the ground. Two of the young women who were there kind of take off and go running into the apartment complex. One young man hands over his money. And during the course of the robbery, the other young man is killed. He's shot and killed. And the assailants sort of take off and get into a car and drive away.
So Curtis Durden was fatally shot. And I understand that one of the assailants pistol whipped the guy who survived, Jeff Simmons.
That's right. And because of sort of the environment in the neighborhood, the police just make an assumption that this is part of a drug turf war, regardless of the fact that this is not somebody who's dealing drugs. And there's no factual grounding for this assumption.
Now, Jerome, you were in front of your friend Kevin's apartment building, about a football field's length away from where this crime occurred, right? A block and a half away. Did you hear the gunshot?
It was close enough to hear. But again, you hear gunshots in the area all the time. So you don't even give a second thought to it. And, you know, again, I was at my friend Kevin's house. We'd been hanging out all morning into the night. And I had made arrangements for my friend Randy to come back to the apartment complex to pick me up, to take me home, since that was on his way home. And as I was sitting in the parking lot with my friends Kai and Harvey, I was sitting in the backseat of the car. And I saw Randy drive by. And I got out of the car and ran into the middle of the street to flag him down. And as I am in the middle of the street flagging Randy down, the patrol car is coming down the avenue, 38th Avenue, and he asked me what I was doing. And I said, I'm trying to flag down my friend Randy, who is right down there. The patrol officer stopped the car, put me in the back of the patrol car, and drove me to the crime scene, which was probably about a block and a half away.
Now, they were looking for someone in a puffy jacket and denim jeans. There was a description of the suspect as well. Did any of it match Jerome?
The person that the police believe Jerome is in this group is described as being in his early to mid-20s, about 5'6 to 5'8, and stocky. And Jerome, of course, at the time is 17, well over 6 feet tall and very slim. And yeah, he's wearing, you know, sweatpants and this Letterman's jacket. So he's also not matching the description of the clothing. And not only does nothing sort of stick out about Jerome, he's picked up on 38th Avenue in the opposite sort of direction from the crime scene that witnesses describe the perpetrators fleeing.
So Jerome didn't match the description, was found in the wrong direction, without a weapon. And I'd like our audience to take a second and imagine your 17-year-old self just waiting on a ride from a friend to continue on with whatever the night had in store for you. And you're basically kidnapped by people with guns and badges.
I was kidnapped by law enforcement. And as I was driven to the crime scene, still in the back of the patrol car, I was met by another patrol officer. He basically said, you know, I had a lot of explaining to do about that dead body. And I could see that there was a body laying on the ground with a white sheet over it. And I had told the officer exactly what I was doing, where I was at, and how my friends are still there, right up the street.
Right. This shooting had just happened. Not only were your alibi witnesses right up the street, but the robbery victims were right there next to their recently deceased friend.
And a police officer shines a light through the window of a police car and asks the eyewitnesses if they can identify Jerome as being one of the group of young men that had committed this robbery. And despite how suggestive that identification procedure is, none of them identified Jerome as being among the group that committed this robbery and murder.
And We've seen that suggestive tactic go the way it was intended to go before, but it didn't work. Jerome was not identified. So this madness should have ended right then and there. But as we know, it didn't.
From there, I was taken to the police station downtown, and they began to question me about the crime. And I was truthful with the officers. I told them exactly what I was doing, where I was at, and who I was with. But that wasn't enough. And I remained there for 25 hours. Well, the first 7 hours of the interrogation, I really thought that they were on my side, that they were seeing where I was at with this incident. But their whole demeanor changed.
And let's not forget, you're 17 years old, just a kid. Did your mother know where you were at this time?
During that time, my mother thought that I was at my friend Kevin's apartment, but I was actually downtown being questioned by investigating officers about a murder that I had no knowledge thereof.
And at some point that morning, the interview transitioned from uniformed officers to detectives, Sergeants Roth and Paniagua, who began to apply more pressure, saying that Jerome's story, that your story wasn't adding up.
And when they asked me if I wanted to take a polygraph examination, I was like, yes, let's do it. I have nothing to hide. As they gave me the polygraph, they said that I had failed the examination.
Yeah, big shocker there. I could have told you they were going to say that. I mean, they used to do it every day, all day, when polygraphs were still admissible as evidence. They'd give you the test. They'd tell you that you failed. And then they'd hope that that would be one of the things that would help to chip away at your resolve.
And their questioning became a lot more harsh. They were telling me things like, you know what they do to little kids like you? You're not telling the truth. We have witnesses that could put you at the crime scene.
Everything that Jerome is describing is consistent with the factors that we know can produce false confessions. Jerome is deprived of sleep. They're using false and exaggerated evidence ploys, both in terms of telling him that other people are placing him at the scene when he wasn't there and couldn't be identified even through the incredibly coercive show up that they did through the police car window. But they're also telling him that he failed a polygraph. The detectives are using the Reed method, which, as your listeners are familiar with, is just a guilt presumptive form of interrogation.
The Reed technique is an interrogation method that was developed in the 1950s by a Chicago Police Department polygraph examiner named John E. Reed. And the method begins by sharing alleged details of the investigation that point to the suspect's guilt. This is called an evidence ploy and can legally be a blatant falsehood, still in 47 states, by the way, to this day. For example, they could say, we found your DNA at the crime scene, whether it's true or not. In this case, they told Jerome that he had failed a polygraph.
A polygraph is a police-created instrument that can't actually tell if somebody's telling the truth. I mean, this is described to Jerome as something that will tell you if you're telling the truth or not, but it's actually an inherent false evidence ploy because it's not capable of spitting out reliable information.
Yeah, it's a cudgel.
Exactly.
When they told me that I failed, like I was just empty inside. I didn't know what else to do.
Once sharing this alleged detail, the investigation creates a high-pressure situation for the suspect. The Reed technique continues, where the interrogator offers socially acceptable justifications for the suspect's alleged behavior, followed by an offer of leniency if the suspect confesses.
The police say, okay, we know you didn't pull the trigger, but we know that you're there. Now, legally, there's no difference between being there at the scene of murder and participating or pulling the trigger, right?
Right. In many states, California being one of them, in the commission of a felony, for example, a robbery, if someone dies, then everyone who participated in that robbery can be prosecuted for murder, even if the person was killed by the police.
Exactly. So again, that's a technique of minimization. They also made him feel like he could leave as soon as he told them what they wanted to know. And so it's this implicit threat of, we're going to hold you here forever until we get what we want.
Going into that 24th hour, that 25th hour, I was becoming nothing more but this empty shell of a child. And I didn't know what else to do. They were telling me, you're not telling the truth. You're a liar. It made me feel like maybe I'm not telling the truth. They got so deep into my mind where I started to believe the opposite.
There are three types of false confessions: voluntary, compliant, and persuaded. This sounds a lot like the latter, where after a lengthy, exhausting interrogation, the subject may actually begin to believe in their own guilt. For example, an interrogator might say, maybe your actions were so heinous that you simply blocked them out. Do you think, you know, you were in a blackout or something? Do you think that's possible? And then if the subject entertains that thought, that can be perceived as an admission of guilt.
In those final hours, I remember them getting so deep into my head to where I felt like I was hopeless. And I remember I put my head on the table and I raised my head and I was like, whatever you guys want to know, I'll tell you. And at that point, the investigating officer, he slammed his hands on the table and said, finally, we're going to get somewhere.
This episode is sponsored by Marsh McLennan, the world's leading professional services firm in the areas of risk, strategy, and people. Its legal and compliance department provides pro bono legal assistance and other support to underrepresented communities and individuals.
The police have this idea that there's a turf war between these rival gangs who are selling drugs, despite the fact that, according to all the eyewitnesses, nobody involved is selling drugs. The victim didn't sell drugs. This was a group of people who were just hanging out in front of their apartment building. But the police have this idea that there had been disagreements over whose turf people were selling drugs on, and that Jerome got everyone together. They get guns, they go over, and they basically exact this retribution, that they tell people to give up the cash and give up the drugs.
They painted a scenario what they believed happened, and they fed that information to me. And they said, why don't you put yourself into that equation? And that equation was, I had a Uzi.
And that somebody he's with shoots the victim with a sawed-off shotgun, and then after that, Jerome fires this gun in the air, and then they take off.
I had incorporated into my statement that after I heard the gunshot and fired the Uzi, I ran to the upward part of the block where I was detained at. I told them in the process of running to that area, I jumped over a fence and ran into a creek area, and that's where I left the gun at. Obviously, none of that was true.
No gun was ever recovered. There's no physical forensic or circumstantial evidence that's recovered that connects with Jerome in any way.
But in my mind, I was like, if I tell them what they wanted to hear, I probably can go home. I probably can get out of this situation. But that was not the truth.
And they sort of get him to put himself in the equation. They get this false confession. Then at 11:48 p.m., a deputy DA comes in and they do like a full taped one that we have a transcript of. When it's like many of the false confessions that you see where this district attorney is speaking in like full paragraphs about what happened, and then Jerome saying like, yes. And then it's like another full paragraph, yes.
Now, the hallmark of most false confessions is that while there'll be some truthful information in there, that the statements also end up being inconsistent with the facts of the crime. Besides this crime not being part of a drug turf war, what else stood out about this particular false confession?
The narrative that the police had come up with was that they were going to take retribution on a guy named Phil. But according to eyewitnesses who actually knew this person, he wasn't there. And when Jerome is giving this confession, he's repeatedly talking about him being there, but then later says, oh, well, maybe he wasn't there. In this confession, he's talking about, well, there are three women and three or four men, but actually there are two men and two women there. At one point, he talks about pointing an Uzi at one of the young men who's there. Well, that person gave money to somebody with a Tech 9 that's also pointed at him, but the eyewitness only describes being robbed by somebody with an Uzi. And he says he was hit with an Uzi on the head, but the police scripted confession doesn't mention that. It also talks about Jerome firing an Uzi in the air to scare off witnesses, but not a single eyewitness to this mentioned that at all. And then Jerome also describes throwing this weapon down as he ran away, but no gun was ever recovered.
So they got the number of people wrong, for starters, 6 or 7 instead of 4. Not a little wrong, a lot wrong. Then the police included both a person who wasn't there named Phil, as well as a non-existent weapon, the Tech 9, but then they forgot to include the pistol whipping with the Uzi, followed by making up the whole thing about the Uzi being fired into the air, and they conjured up this entire story, compounding the tragedy of an actual murder by victimizing Jerome and literally taking his life away. And he was just a 17-year-old kid.
At the end of this questioning, I finally was allowed to call my mom home. And when I did finally get that call, I said, "Mom, they have me downtown for murder." And my mother was in disbelief. And I remember hearing on the phone, she said to my sister, "I know this voice on the other line, but this is not Jerome." She handed the phone to my sister and said, "Find out who this is. This does not sound like Jerome." My sister Leah picked the phone up. She said, "Hello, who is this?" And I said, "It's Jerome. They got me downtown for murder." So the initial charges were first degree murder, 3 counts of robbery, and assault with a deadly weapon. My public defender came to me and said, "Based on my confession, I have the best deal for you." And that was a 6-year deal in the California Youth Authority.
And in 1991, at the time that you were being processed, it was really essentially a fool's errand to even try to convince a jury that anybody under any circumstances would confess to something that they hadn't done. Even if your public defender managed to point out all of the wild inconsistencies really between your statement and the facts of the crime.
My public defender never suggested that I do go to trial so that all that information could be presented. The conversation from start to finish was, "I have a guaranteed deal for you, and I'm advising you to take it because you gave a confession. And there's no way that you could win a case based on the confession that you've given. And so my only option, based on what my public defender was telling me, was to take this guaranteed 6-year deal to the California Youth Authority for first-degree murder, 3 counts of robbery, and assault with a deadly weapon. And that by taking this deal, I would be released before my 25th birthday."
Considering the alternative, you'd be looking at a life sentence. So 6 years in juvie or life?
Being released before my 25th birthday was in sight. It was in my vision. And again, I believe that what my public defender was telling me was the best call. And so I took the deal.
And just to sort of provide context, just because it's so bizarre, at the proceeding where, you know, Jerome first enters into this agreement, the judge says, "All right, so you'll go to the California Youth Authority, you'll be there until you're 25, and then you'll be released." This is assuming that the California Youth Authority accepts you. Given the reports that I've seen, I believe that they will. And so there's a body, the Youthful Offender Parole Board, who determines whether or not somebody is eligible to be at the CYA. The board flat out rejects Jerome because of the circumstances of the crime.
And so 6 months into that deal, I was brought back to court. It was vacated, at which point I was told that the district attorney's office felt like I should cooperate with the office by giving up the names of the individuals that were involved in this crime. And by not giving up the names, I would go to trial and I would received the maximum sentence of 50 years to life in prison. But if I don't go to trial, I could plead to a lesser and receive, rather than 50 years, I could receive an 18-year to life sentence. And I didn't have names. I never did. And so the next phase was to vacate the original sentence and plead to the lesser charge, which would be second-degree murder.
And so, after having taken the original deal for 6 years in juvie, that would be a hard thing for anyone to swallow as an innocent person. Since you had already pleaded guilty, though, then you were faced with a choice between 50 to life or 18 to life.
You know, my faith in God was shattered. I didn't believe that there was a God. What kind of God would put a child through something like this? I couldn't believe that this was happening to me. There was no one in authority that stood up to the plate and said, wait a minute, something is not right here.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
It was the summer of 1996 that I was transferred from the Youth Authority to the Department of Corrections prison. In the Youth Authority, the mindset is different. It's about rehabilitation, therapy. When you get to prison, it's none of that. It's a dark world. And I had to grow up really quick. And I remember when I first hit the prison yard, I was met by an individual. And he said to me, youngster, if you want to survive this, there's three things that you should do. Don't fuck with punks, don't gamble, and don't click up, i.e. being a gang member. He said, if you take those three things, you survive this madness. That's all he said. And for 21 years, I never clicked up, didn't mess with punks. And it was difficult because I was ostracized in so many different ways. I had a mark on my back because I wasn't part of a gang. I didn't click up. The only neutral zone, safe zone that I could exist on was the track. So I ran 4 hours a day. Every time they opened a yard, I would just go to the yard and run.
I guess you can't get dragged into any more drama if you're just running and don't engage with anyone.
Or you could try running with me and try to have a conversation, but that wasn't going to happen. For the first couple of years that I was incarcerated, I was in a dark place where I just wouldn't say anything to anybody. The last thing that I wanted to do was be judged again and again, especially for a crime I didn't do. I didn't want to be mocked and scorned by my peers. When they asked me what I was in there for, I would say, I'm in here for murder. Some of the things that I did in prison, for starters, I always use this analogy. How did I stay sane going through all of that? And if I could paint the picture of you holding a live grenade, it would be just imagine your 18th birthday, all the milestones, your 21st, 25th, 30th, my nieces and nephews being born, my siblings being married, my dad passed away a year to the date that I came home. And all of this was encapsulated in this live grenade that I had to hold on to. And that live grenade represent my sanity. And I knew that the moment that I would let that live grenade go would be the moment I would explode or implode. While in prison, I also did hospice care. That was an eye-opening for me, is to sit with terminally ill patients, just to know these individuals, not to know them from their criminal past, but just to know them as an individual. And they would always give me insight. You're young. You have your whole life ahead of you. Don't make the mistakes like I did. I took all of that into consideration. I learned some good things in prison. I learned some bad things in prison.
What are a few lessons you learned? If you could tell us, pick like the first three to come to mind.
Number one, I would say I had to be honest with myself in understanding why I confessed to a crime I didn't do. Reliving that episode was very traumatic, but I had to come to terms with it and I had to accept it. With that being said, I had to talk with that 17-year-old kid and I had to become that 17-year-old kid's protector, his man. And I had to always speak for that 17-year-old kid because nobody spoke for him. Number two, I had to learn how to respect myself at all times. When you respect yourself at all times, the people around you would see that respect and they would honor that. It's not like that for everybody, but it was like that for me. And I would say the third thing would be to honor the people that kept me sane while I was in there, i.e. my family. My family was my mainstay from start to finish of my incarceration.
Yeah, you know, that support, not everyone has it, but it goes a long way if you do. We hear it time and again on the show and even just doing the work. And I understand that in addition to the hospice care, which, by the way, my hat's off to you, but you also finished high school inside, behind the bars, and you did your time, get this, with zero disciplinary infractions? It's almost unheard of.
It's hard to do, and you know what? I never wanted to represent where I was at. I didn't want to become a product of that system. Again, I'm not speaking for everybody. I'm only speaking for self. The last thing that I wanted to do, for example, was call my mom and say, hey, mom, guess what? I'm a gang member now. So, yes, it was a fine line that I had to walk, but it was something that was necessary for me because I was not a murderer. And I did not want to act like I was a murderer by being a product of that system. So I remained disciplinary free for 21 and a half years.
I mean, when I got Jerome's C file, which is the file that they assemble for you in the CDCR, normally you go through these files and it's like disciplinary hearing after disciplinary hearing after disciplinary hearing. And that's because no matter what your intentions are, no matter the level of your self-control, it's next to impossible to spend time in prison, particularly in a maximum security institution, right? Even if you're not looking for trouble, a lot of times trouble is going to find you. And so, I mean, it's just a testament to the incredible sort of force of will that Jerome had, that he was able to stay discipline-free. But instead, it was just like a bunch of laudatory statements. I mean, I told him when I first reviewed this, I was like, Jerome, you could take this C file and apply to college.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I also understand that the very little bit of money that you were able to make in there, because you were making 95 cents an hour in the print shop, that you donated to charity.
I just wanted to feel some type of connection to the real world. And I felt like by donating the money that I made in there to charitable causes in society would give me some type of connection to the free world.
And so while you're in there living this honorable, even heroic existence, your avenues for relief and post-conviction were not promising at all with the guilty plea. And then you were repeatedly denied at the parole board in 2002, 2005, and 2008.
So my initial stance while appearing before the parole board was, I'm not going to talk about the life crime. If anything, I'll talk about what I've been doing since I've been incarcerated and what I plan to do upon my release. And that was doing more harm than good because I wasn't providing any insight.
And then at your 2008 hearing, as I understand it, you started claiming your actual innocence.
There was a statement that was made by the district attorney, and she basically said that I was taking steps back because I was saying that I didn't commit the crime. Fast forward, going into my 2011 hearing, I wrote out a statement explaining how a 17-year-old kid was put in an adult situation who was forced to confess to a crime he didn't do, who was now a 38-year-old man fighting for his freedom. Their response was that they believed my story and they gave me a release date.
Which was October 17th, 2011. Tell us about that.
It was very special in so many ways. I didn't believe that it would happen, but it happened. I was met by my sisters. I wish my dad would have been there to see me walk out. All I wanted him to do was to see me walk out of there strong and sane. But I made it out with my sanity. That was key. Was walking out of there with my sanity. They wrote me off. There were some that said that I wouldn't make it out alive. I proved them wrong.
Yes, you did. And now you are out on parole and you are going to be under supervision for another 5 years, though, with plenty of pitfalls in your path, all sorts of obstacles and hoops you had to jump through. But you didn't let that stop you.
When I first came home, I had a job offer at a law firm. And I walked into the law firm my second day home. And I didn't have a suit and tie. And they purchased me 5 suits. And they said that I was required to wear one to work every day. They said that they opened the office at 9 o'clock. I was there at 8 o'clock. And from there, I transitioned to becoming a project manager for a construction company. I stayed with the construction company for about 8 years. And then I transitioned to becoming an active member of an organization called the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, which I am now vice chairman of the board. We do a lot of policy work and advocacy work, which brought me to this place now of speaking on behalf of all the children out there who have been duped into confessions that they didn't do. And so I'm on a campaign now to get child Miranda rights across the board. I'm working with 2 Congress personnel, Congressman Tony Cardenas and Representative Sidney Camlogger Dove, on federalizing juvenile Miranda rights across the board.
That's amazing. So this isn't just California. This is federal juvenile Miranda rights. So what can our audience do to help?
Number one, you can Google the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, and as well as Congressman Tony Cardenas, as well as Representative Sidney Camlogger Dove, to get more information on the juvenile Miranda right bill package.
So we'll have antirecidivism.org as well as other action steps linked in the bio. Now, before we go to closing arguments, I've heard you've also gotten married since you've been out.
Yeah, I got married to a beautiful wife. Her name is Raha. She is the apple of my eye. I'm just now understanding puppy love. It was something that I should have taken on when I was 15 or 16. I waited until I was 50 to understand the philosophy of love. And it truly is a beautiful experience. We just purchased a nice home. Like, I couldn't ask for anything more considering where I came from.
Hell yeah.
Thank you.
And I want to turn to Ben because he also has a call to action for what he's working on now. And there's a number of us working on this, which is to finally and permanently clear Jerome's name.
So after wrongful conviction like that, normally you think about a habeas petition. But since Jerome served his sentence and wasn't even on parole anymore because it had been terminated so quickly because he was a monoparolee, the best avenue for doing that would be to seek a gubernatorial pardon from Gavin Newsom's office. And so we've undertaken an investigation, just going back 33 years to when this crime occurred. And we've got a great private investigator who's gone around and interviewed eyewitnesses, interviewed alibi witnesses, people who were around the scene of the crime. We have statements from all of them. We got Dr. Richard Leo, who, as your listeners know, is one of the foremost experts in the field, who put together a report about Jerome's false confession, and he details all of the risk factors that were present and all the indicia of unreliability. And so we've sent that to the governor's office. Now we're at the point where we're supplementing it with letters. And so people who know Jerome are writing the governor. And also, just if anyone who's listening to this is moved, they can do that as well.
All right. Well, we're going to add that to the action steps as well. And now we've come to my favorite part of the show, where I first of all get to thank you both for joining us. And Jerome, thank you again for sharing your incredible story. Your journey is absolutely amazing. And now I'm going to kick back in my chair with my headphones on, turn my microphone off, close my eyes, and just listen to anything else you feel is left to be said. So let's start off with Ben, and then Jerome, you take us out into the sunset.
What happened to Jerome was an outrage, but it isn't unique. It's what happens when assumptions about Black communities and the people who live there combine with the policing that does nothing to advance public safety and actually affirmatively endangers people by taking them away from the people who love them, in this case, for 21 years. And so clearing Jerome's name is important, not just because it's the right thing to do, but also because it'll make him a more effective advocate in trying to stop this from happening to other children.
I have to agree with Ben 100%. My case is not unique. I am not a unicorn. I was an individual, one of many, who was forced to confess to a crime that they didn't do. And it should not have happened, and it needs to stop. I wish I could say that I'm the last of many who has went through something as horrible as confessing to a crime that they didn't do, but I'm not. We know that it's going to happen again and again and again, and I want to be made whole. I want my name back, and I need to be cleared from all charges.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall, Annie Chelsea, and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.